I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today on this archive edition of Midday, a conversation with George Will and Thomas Frank about the state of conservatism in America. Thomas Frank is the author of What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. He wonders why Donald Trump's brutish brand of populism appears to have displaced the moderate wing of the Republican Party. In his latest book, The Conservative Sensibility, George Will asserts that conservatives must ask, what do we seek to conserve? And he argues for a return to the philosophy of limited government espoused by James Madison. Our show was taped last month, so we can't take your calls and emails. George Will and Thomas Frank join me after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Today, it's a conversation about the state of conservatism in America. A little later in our program, I'll be joined by Thomas Frank, a columnist for The Guardian newspaper and the author of several books, including What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. But we begin today with the Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist and the author of 15 books, George Will. His latest is a passionate cri de coeur for conservatives to return to the vision of the founders, who sought a limited role for government premised on natural rights and a sophisticated understanding of human nature. Human nature, he argues, is predictable and permanent. A proclivity to behave according to self-interest, for example, is more realistic an expectation than counting on citizens to be inherently virtuous. And it was this kind of assumption that animated the framers as they conjured a constitution that was unprecedented in human history. Mr. Will asserts that current political thought is in large measure an argument between a view of the Constitution espoused by James Madison, a framer who was our nation's fourth president, and Woodrow Wilson, the 28th chief executive. In what he calls a summons to pessimism, his book argues and laments that a Wilsonian view of the role of government has taken hold intractably. The book is called The Conservative Sensibility. George Will joins us on the line from his office in Washington, D.C. Mr. Will, welcome, sir.
Glad to be with you.
So let's begin with the notion of natural rights that you write about quite persuasively and interestingly, and that you write about them as emanating from a secular premise, not a sacred premise. You say a secular basis for natural rights reasoning is that rights are natural in the sense that they are discovered by something that is natural, which is reason. How are natural rights arrived at by reason?
By examining the experience of the human race and identifying rights that are essential to the flourishing of creatures with our natures. You're quite right to note that I do not ground this in any theology. In fact, perhaps I should have moved up earlier in the book the chapter called Conservatism Without Theism, in which I identify myself as an amiable low-voltage atheist and argue that you can get to all the conclusions I want to come to without recourse to any theism at all.
And when you say that this philosophy of natural rights, which is the founder's philosophy, and it was interesting to me for you to report, because this isn't something I think I knew, and I learned a lot when I read your book, that the founders themselves, we have a mythology that they were all deeply religious people, and that, you know, we have a Judeo-Christian creed that is the premise of the Constitution and even the Declaration. But that's not the case. The religion did not play a major animating role in the thinking of the founders.
To the extent that they were religious, many of them were deists, and I think it's a mistake to count deism as a religion. A religion is supposed to explain, enjoin, and console, and I don't see what deism does. Deism is the idea that a distant God wound up the universe like a clock and then absconded. Someone has said that deism is like the god of deism is like a rich aunt in Australia, vaguely benevolent but rarely heard from. or someone else said the deist god is the god who winds our sundials. But their language of the founders was flecked with references to the author of our being or divine providence. But that's, again, almost a verbal tick. George Washington, who was famously and inaccurately portrayed in a painting on his knees in prayer at Valley Forge, would go to the Anglican Church, and when he was reproved by the priest for not taking communion, he simply skipped church when communion was going to be served.
Yeah. One of the great responses to deism in England around this time in the 1740s is George Frideric Handel, who wrote his musical setting of texts from the Bible assembled for him by a friend called Messiah. And it was intended to counter this growing philosophy of deism. So, you know, worldwide, this was something that was certainly taking hold. But one of the fundaments of this philosophy of natural rights that you write about rests on the premise that there is a universal human nature. What is it that the founders understood about human nature, and how did that understanding then inform their writing of the Constitution?
Their understanding was that human beings have possession of themselves, that they when they used the phrase, as they often did, life, liberty, and property as the basic rights instead of the pursuit of happiness, there was really the same thing, because they said, we have possession of ourselves, we have possession of the property we acquire by mixing our labor with it, and it is well to understand that instead of doing political philosophy as the ancients did, that is, by postulating the highest that man could achieve and aiming for it, it would be better to understand the worst outcomes in politics and try to avoid them. And one way to do that is to take your bearings from the strong, steady passions that animate human beings. This was the essence of Madison's revolution in democratic theory. Before Madison, the very few philosophers who had thought that democracy was A, possible, or B, advisable, said it could only work in a small face-to-face society, something like Rousseau's Geneva or Pericles' Athens, a place you could walk across in a day, because the great ailment of democracies, they thought, was factions. Madison turned this on its head. He had a different catechism. He said, what is the worst outcome of politics? The answer is tyranny. What is the form of tyranny to which democracies are prey? Tyranny of the majority. Solution: don't have stable, tyrannical majorities. Have majorities only that are shifting, unstable coalitions of minorities. Therefore, he said, you want to have an extensive republic, one that would give rise to a saving multiplicity of factions. Hence, he said in Federalist 10, the primary duty of government is to protect the different and unequal capacities of acquiring property, because that will produce this saving factions.
It's also interesting that you you bring up the role of sort of serendipity and randomness. You quote a beautiful poem by Philip Larkin called Going, Going, in which he has the line, most things are never meant. And you say that it's a central insight of conservatism that most social arrangements, even things like families and communities and commercial systems, are not meant. So by that, do you mean that it's impossible for government or any entity to mean something and try to create it from scratch?
It is difficult, if not impossible, to create from scratch. And once a society is up and running in all its complexity and spontaneous order, it is a mistake for government to assume that it can judge better than a market can how wealth and opportunity should be generated and allocated. I quote in there a very intelligent Washington writer, Virginia Postrel, who says the story of the Bible can be reduced to one sentence. God created man and woman and then lost control of events. The conservative sensibility finds the lack of control exhilarating. And it does so because the conservative sensibility admires and wants to cultivate what Friedrich Hayek called it the spontaneous order of a market society. Markets are just mechanisms for generating information. And the creativity, the dynamism of society, the creative destruction of society, to use Schumpeter's famous phrase, is to the conservative sensibility welcome, rather than the progressive impulse, which is to bring science to bear through public administration, through the administrative state, to govern a complex society from the top down, which Hayek warned against. He said it is the fatal conceit to believe that governments can master the complexities of society. Indeed, I think the great progressive non sequitur is this. Progressives said, look, the separation of powers and limited government was all very well when we were not a complex society, but now that we're a continental society, industrial and commercial and complicated, now we need government of similar complexity and ambition and sprawl. Actually, the more complicated society becomes, the less government knows relative to what there is to be known about the society, and a certain modesty is in order, what Hayek called epistemic humility.
But if a conservative sensibility includes a sort of celebration or elevation of those things that are out of one's control, what about the things that were, in fact, controlled and things that everybody, conservative, progressive, liberal, whatever term you want to use, agreed were bad? For example, racism in America was controlled. It was conjured. Slavery was controlled. Jim Crow was controlled. Elimination or subjugation of voting rights in the early part of the 20th century was controlled. And at some point, it had to be uncontrolled. It had to be reversed. Isn't there a role for some control and some role of government in that control?
Certainly. No, conservatives are not anarchists. Conservatives believe that government should stigmatize and proscribe certain injuries to the public good, racism being one, slavery being the most lurid of them all. One of the heroes of my book is, of course, Lincoln. I grew up in central Illinois, marinated in the spirit of Lincoln. I grew up in Champaign-Urbana, a university town where my father taught. And according to local lore, Lincoln, who was a traveling prosperous railroad lawyer, was in the Champaign County Courthouse when he heard that Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas had succeeded in passing the Kansas-Nebraska Act. The premise of that act was that we should solve the vexing question of whether slavery could expand into the territories by submitting it to a vote. Popular sovereignty in the territories was Stephen A. Douglas's cry. Lincoln's recoil from this, his insistence that America is not about a majority rule, it's about liberty, and that majority rule is good to the extent that it serves liberty, propelled him on the greatest career, in my judgment, in the history of world politics.
And your basic argument here is that it's the dichotomy between a Madisonian and a Wilsonian constitutional interpretation. James Madison, a framer, president during the Revolutionary War, 1809 to 17, and then Woodrow Wilson, exemplar of what you might call the modern presidency. Wilson argued that the separation of powers, you know, were required when we were getting ourselves together and starting, but now that we've matured, at that point it was, you know, the early part of the 20th century, we no longer needed as acute a separation of powers. Because of our maturity, I mean, isn't in fact incorrect to assert that the Republic is a very different place in 1913 than it was in 1787, and it's considerably different now in 2019 than it was at either of those two times?
Certainly it's different. The question is, however, were the founders' premises, did they expire somewhere along the way? And I think not. Woodrow Wilson was the first president to criticize the American founding, which he did not do peripherally. He did it root and branch. He said the separation of powers is wrong, the natural rights doctrine is wrong. He said, don't read the first two paragraphs of the Declaration. It's 4th of July rhetoric that can only mislead you. What we need, he said, was to get over our fear of factions, because in our new modern maturity, we're all agreed on everything, so there's a great vast saving consensus. Second, he said, we need to marginalize Congress and have an emancipated president who can wield executive power, more and more power in Washington, more and more Washington power in the presidency, and more executive power delegated through the presidency to administrative agencies. Now, if you like the condition of our government today, you can tune out. If you like, that is, a presidency so emancipated that he can wage war when he wants, a president that can take funds appropriated for purpose A and spend it instead on purpose B simply by declaring a national emergency under laws passed by Congress, giving the president's vast powers of discretion. If you like all this, then fine. But a lot of us don't. A lot of us feel that there's an attenuated accountability in the administrative state and that the presidency itself has become dangerously untethered from control.
And that untetheredness transcends Republican or Democratic administrations.
Absolutely. The laws that have enabled presidents to get this way have been passed by Congresses under both parties, and the powers have flowed to presidents of both parties. This is a bipartisan failing.
You write also about the importance or the significance of self-interest as opposed to virtue. And you said that the system, early in the book, you observed that the constitutional system did not presuppose a constant supply of public-spiritedness. Is that the problem with Wilsonian perspective on this, that he and his adherents, people like Franklin Roosevelt and Barack Obama and whomever you want to choose, asserted that we do need to act from a premise of public spiritedness because we are a large country and we have to live together. We have to learn how to live together and to help those folks who are having a difficult time helping themselves.
The founders themselves were public spirited, and the founders hoped for and expected there to be some public spiritedness. They simply were not willing to develop a system that depended upon a constant supply, a dominating supply of public spiritedness. In Federalist 51, Madison says, you will see throughout our system the process of supplying by opposite and rival interests the defect of better motives. That is, he expected that the legislative branch would be rivalrous with the executive branch. What he did not anticipate, but the founders neither anticipated nor desired, was the very rapid evolution of political parties, to the point at which now in 2019 we see the Republicans in Congress thinking of themselves as subordinate teammates to the president of their party, just as Democrats, when they have a Democratic president, Democrats in Congress think of themselves as and behave as subordinate teammates simply supporting the president. That is, that this kind of party loyalty over institutional dignity and loyalty short circuits the entire Madisonian equilibrium that was built into our system.
I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. My guest today is George Will. His new book is very provocative, quite persuasive in many parts, and a very compelling read. It's called The Conservative Sensibility. George, you write a lot about leveling the playing field, which is a term of art that we hear a lot, particularly on campaign trails during presidential primaries, etc. And you say that the conservative sensibility cherishes the distinction between the public and private spheres of life. Is there no responsibility of the body politic writ large to address the inequities that have grown, the systemic inequities that have grown in things like, you write a lot about the GI Bill, for example, but the GI Bill grossly advantaged white people over black people. Education policy, housing policy, a lot of that stuff, the same can be said. Is there no role for the central federal government to address those inequities that by custom or by pernicious intent have grown up in our culture?
There certainly is, but inequity is not a synonym for inequality. If you say you're for liberty, you are for inequality. Different people have different aptitudes and different desires. Some people in our society want to teach kindergarten. Some people want to run hedge funds. Bless them all. But a free society will be inevitably an unequal society, as unequal talents and aptitudes manifest themselves in the working of a free society. So my primary warning is against the conflation of inequality with inequity.
When it comes to income inequality, you say that there are three economic conditions that are important causes of distress: poverty, insecurity, and inequality. And you say that the latter, inequality, is surely the least important. And that the moral imperative for us should be that everybody has enough. But isn't it the case that there are plenty of people who don't have enough? They don't
sure
have nearly enough.
Of course there are. And the United States goes to enormous efforts to try and correct this. 67% of our federal budget is transfer payments. The sky of America is dark with checks flying back and forth as we try and allocate wealth to people who ostensibly need it. Some of it, of course, is going to agribusinesses and the rest, which hardly need it, but that's another matter. The question is this: to try a thought experiment. Suppose you could wave a wand right now and triple everyone's income, rich, poor, middle class, everyone's income got tripled. Suddenly, you would have people who had been did not have enough. They would have enough. For how long would people be content? I would estimate something between 6 seconds and 6 hours, at which point a kind of restless enviousness would take over, envy being the only one of the seven deadly sins that doesn't give the sinner even momentary pleasure. It seems to me that, try another thought experiment. I often do this when I'm talking to audiences around the country. I say, show of hands, please, how many of you have an Apple product in your pocket? Most of the hands in the room go up. And how many of you have an Apple product in your home? Again, a forest of hands grows up. Then I say, how many of you resent the fact that Steve Jobs, who made all this possible, died a billionaire? No hands go up. A lot of people become billionaires because they add tremendous social value. The idea that Steve Jobs reaped most of the value of what he created is facially preposterous. The great value of what he did is in our pockets.
But on the flip side of that is, what about the people who don't have anything? At one point you write that the problem is behavior, it's not material poverty. But material poverty is a really difficult problem to overcome on a daily basis. And to get yourself out of that cycle is really, really difficult.
It is very difficult. And it's made more difficult because of a culture of poverty and because of attitudes and aptitudes that are conducive to the intergenerational transmission of poverty. It is well known that if you obey three rules, graduate from high school, don't have a child until you're married, and don't marry until you're 20 years old, your chances of winding up in poverty are vanishingly small. What we've learned, and this is the heart of my chapter on opportunity and culture, what we've learned in our difficult, painful learning experience of the last 50 years is that the cultural impediments to rising resist the most ameliorative government programs. That is, when in a famous exchange that Hemingway claims to have had with Fitzgerald, where Fitzgerald says the rich are not like us, and Hemingway says, that's right, they have more money. That's not the full explanation of class differences in America.
Is that because the programs are designed poorly, or is it because there is no program that could possibly be designed correctly?
It's because money is not the problem. What we learned to our sorrow in the mid-1960s was that we saw developing, in the midst of an economic boom of the 1960s, we saw welfare caseloads also boom. Something was going on, and what was going on was family disintegration. and we now know that families are the primary transmitters of social capital, by which I mean the habits, mores, customs, dispositions necessary for taking advantage of a free society's opportunities. And when that begins to break down, you can redistribute income all you like, and you will not stop the transmission of poverty. As Moynihan, Pat Moynihan, who probably recurs, he was A, my best friend, and B, he's constant presence in my book. What Moynihan rightly said was that if we gave directly to the poor one-third of the money we're spending on poverty programs, there'd be no poor people, at least in the sense that they would have that money. But whether or not you can equip people by giving them transfer payments to prosper in a society is now very much in doubt.
I want to move to politics. We just have a few minutes left. I know you have a busy agenda today. You say that there are four, not three, national institutions created by the Constitution: the Congress, the Supreme Court, the presidency, and you name as the fourth the presidential selection system of the Electoral College. You are a fan of the Electoral College, I guess.
I am indeed. I think it encourages moderation. It encourages candidates to campaign in many regions. It encourages coalition building, which leads to moderation in politics. And by the way, it ain't going away. One of the reasons, the main reason, that opponents of the Electoral College want to get rid of it is it does indeed, because each state gets two electoral votes for its two senators, it does give somewhat added weight to the less populous states. What that means is at least 13 of those states, which is all it takes to defeat a constitutional amendment, at least 13 of those states are going to vote against an amendment abolishing the Electoral College. What mystifies me is why so many Democratic candidates are spending so much time talking about something they surely know, as politically sophisticated people, is not going to happen.
Finally, you write about the cultural contradiction of conservatism in that it demands from citizens a sort of self-denial of public-spiritedness. But on the other hand, that's not an easy thing to do in a commercial republic of the sort that conservatism celebrates, where individualism enjoys maximum scope for pursuits. There is a dichotomy there. And I wonder, are there any current Republican practitioners of the kind of Madisonian constitutionalism that you advocate? And if not, where does a constitutional conservative hang his hat
in
this day and age?
They're pretty thin on the ground right now. One of the reasons people like me write books like the book I've written is to try and begin to shift the sand of public opinion and to make this persuasion attractive and politically palatable. I would say that there are some senators, Rob Portman of Ohio, the Republican from Ohio, Pat Toomey, Republican from Pennsylvania, Ben Sasse, Republican from Nebraska, who I think understand the disequilibrium that now afflicts the federal government, and who understand the cultural problems of conservatism in, as you say, a society that celebrates a sort of unbounded appetite.
As we finish up here, you quote at great length a good friend of ours, a guy who's been on the show many times from the American Enterprise Institute, an economist named Nick Eberstadt. And Nick talks about the paucity of men. He wrote a wonderful book about how few men are in the workforce during their most productive years, and that disability abuse is rampant. It is a difficult thing for our government or any entity to decide who's deserving and who isn't. What, in your view, is the best way of calculating, in fact, who are deserving and need assistance from the government and who are not, assuming that you do agree that there are some that certainly do need a lift, at least at some point in their lives?
Certainly. There's no question, as Nick Eberstadt demonstrates, that the Social Security disability program has been gamed and abused by people who are simply would like to use the welfare state to enable them to leave the workforce. You mentioned earlier the GI Bill. The GI Bill is really the model of conservative entitlement in this sense. It said to people leaving that when we had 12 million people were about to be demobilized from service in the Second World War, the GI Bill said, if you will do the, sir, you've already rendered a public service by being in uniform. If you will do certain things that serve the public good, A, go to school, B, get married and buy a home, hence the mortgage assistance under the GI Bill, then you will be eligible for government assistance. The idea that government assistance can be linked to socially useful behavior is not radical, and it is, I think, conservative.
George Will, his new book is called The Conservative Sensibility. George, this book has all the qualities of books that, all the kinds of books that I like. It was revelatory. It was fascinating. It was beautifully written, and it drove me nuts some of the times. And I very much appreciate your time today and appreciate the book.
I've enjoyed this very much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Coming up, we continue our exploration of conservatism in the current political moment with Thomas Frank. He's a columnist for The Guardian newspaper and the author of several books, including What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. His latest is called Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. Tom Frank joins me here in Studio A. After a quick break, I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, a pre-4th of July edition of What You Got Cookin' with chefs John Shields of Gertrude's Restaurant and Damian Mosley. He's the proprietor of a terrific place called Black Sauce Kitchen. Damian and John will take your questions and share their tips for the perfect holiday barbecue, crab boil, or clam bake. Plus, J. Wynne Russick reviews Hamilton at the Hippodrome Theater here in Baltimore. If you're just joining us today, we're discussing the state of conservatism in America. And we turn now to the political analyst and Guardian columnist Thomas Frank. He is the New York Times bestselling author of many books, including What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatism Won the Heart of America. His latest book is called Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. Tom, it's good to see you, sir.
It is so great to be here in Baltimore, Mr. Hall.
So Mr. Will talked about income inequality and sort of dismissed it as as not that big a deal. You write in your book on What's the Matter with Kansas about how in so many instances there were people voting against their self-interest.
Yeah.
And with those whose income was, you know, skyrocketing exponentially above their own. How do you assess income inequality specifically as an issue that we need to think about when we talk about policy, et cetera?
I think income inequality, I mean, and I, by the way, it's not a word that I like. Equality, it sounds technical. The 19th century, they called it the social, what was it, the social issue.
Hmm.
How are we going to live together? If you ask me, that is the central issue of American politics. It's not something peripheral. It's not something minor. It's the basic question that has drawn the political battle line since this country was founded, whether you're talking about Jefferson and Hamilton or whether you're talking about, you know, what George Will was talking about, you know, the conservatives and liberals in the 1960s. Now, today, it's scrambled. You know, which party is on whose side, it's sometimes very difficult to tell. But in my opinion, that is the central issue. And one of the reasons for, and I almost hate to say this, but one of the reasons for Donald Trump's success as a presidential candidate in 2016 is that he seemed to be talking about that in a way that made sense to a lot of people who are on the receiving end of inequality, people who are not doing great. I mean, he deliberately tried to sound like a Bernie Sanders kind of character. He doesn't rule that way. He hasn't been, you know,
yeah.
That's all forgotten now.
Looks can be deceiving, can't they? Yeah. And you've written that Trumpism in the hands of a real politician has the potential to thrive for a long time. So taking Mr. Trump personally out of the equation, but espousing some of what Mr. Trump's brand of populism is, could in fact be a very lasting thing. I think a lot of Democrats are assuming or hoping this is a blip on the map. This is what Mr. Biden seems
yeah,
to
we'll
be
all
asserting.
Get back to normal.
We'll get back
day
to normal.
Now.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah. The, you know, all the nice people with Ivy League degrees will be back in the saddle in Washington and everything will be hunky-dory, you know. No. Yeah. Look, the reason I say that, that I said that Trumpism in the hands of a different person is going to be really hard to beat. Trump, in some ways, really fractured the consensus of the last couple of years. You look at something like the issue of trade, where there was, you know, there's
which used to be a Republican thing.
Well, yes. And then the Democrats came around to the Republican position in the Clinton administration. You remember NAFTA and all that. And for Democrats, this was a huge deal when they signed on to that sort of modern idea of free trade agreements. And here comes Trump in the Republican Party promising to shatter these agreements and smashing this consensus. Now, if you ask me, what he's done so far is largely for show. Well, we can talk about that at some other time. But basically what I'm saying is that Trump, there were some real novelties about what he was doing. But the reason, to put this in long-term perspective, the reason I think that Trumpism is probably here to stay is because it's been going on for my entire adult life. I was born in 65. Richard Nixon became president in 68, promising to help the, what was his term, the silent majority. And it's just been one dose of fake populism, of conservative outreach to hard done by working class people from that day to this. Ronald Reagan was very good at that kind of message. George Bush Sr., not so good at it, but George Bush Jr., excellent at it. Newt Gingrich, very good at it. The Tea Party movement, excellent. Glenn Beck, excellent. Sarah Palin, very good. And here comes Trump, and he expands the rhetoric slightly. He also pisses off so— am I allowed to say that on the radio, by the way?
Hope so.
He's made so many people so angry. So think about Trumpism in the hands of someone who doesn't do that, who doesn't go down the list of American ethnic groups and insult them each in turn, which Trump did.
And does
every day, yeah. Trumpism in the hands of someone who didn't do that would be really hard to stop.
What about Mr. Will's contention that we've created a culture of dependency because the government has intervened and tried to affect people's lives and improve them if they have in fact been marginalized or if they have in fact been systematically left out of the American bounty? Is it a chicken and the egg thing? Is the fact that the government has tried to intervene created this culture, did the culture exist prior to that, and the government's just feeding it?
You know, it's a big issue, and you're asking exactly the right guy, because as it happens, this morning I drove up here from the beautiful suburb of Bethesda, Maryland, where I am writing a book about
this very thing.
about what happened with the Democratic Party and how they got to be where they are and whatever became of populism. And I'm reading a lot of books from the 80s and 90s. There was a sort of intellectual war at the time over welfare and whether or not welfare caused poverty or whether or not welfare was a response to poverty. And the upshot of all that literature was that we abolished the welfare program, AFDC. We abolished it Bill Clinton signed that in 1996.
And since welfare to work.
That's right. But they basically forgot about it. They turned it over to the states and it's gone. And since then, extreme poverty has spiked in this country. It is out of control. You can see this in Baltimore. You can see this in small town. I'm originally from Kansas City. You can see that everywhere you go in this country, every small town, every big city, that these conditions are out of control. They're not this sort of permanent, lasting, biblical thing. They go up and they go down. And I would say inequality does the same thing. And we can measure it. It's, you know, this is easy to do. There were times in this country when, for example, labor unions were strong and working class people did very well. And there are times when you know, like the present, where the opposite is the case and everything goes to the Walmart heirs or, you know, yeah. or similar people.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with and have more with Thomas Frank. He's an author, political analyst. He's on leave from The Guardian, where he's an essayist and columnist. He's writing a book about populism. We are talking about the current state of conservatism in America. More with Tom Frank when we come back. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about conservatism in America in the age of Trump. I spoke earlier with George Will about his latest book, The Conservative Sensibility. Thomas Frank joins me now in Studio A. So what do the terms conservative and progressive mean in this era of hyper-bifurcated political polarity? And looking ahead to 2020, can the Democrats provide a unifying antidote to the divisiveness of Donald Trump? And is unifying the country even an aspiration of either political party? And is unity a necessary condition for an effective democracy? Thomas Frank is a best-selling author of What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. His latest book is called Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. What about that question about unification? George Will asserts that, you know, Woodrow Wilson basically said, okay, we've grown up now. We're no longer in the founding stage. We're in the mature stage. We've got enough consensus. We've got enough unity in the country so the government can play a different role, and that the separations clause or the separations philosophy is no longer necessary. Mr. Trump, one of the least unifying presidents in the history of the American presidency. I mean, and again, maybe he's kind of leaving Trump to the side, if that's even remotely possible. Is unity a necessary condition for our democracy to function effectively?
Well, no, because, you know, factions are natural and they happen and there's nothing you can do about it. By the way, George Will said something really interesting at the very start of your interview where he said the first question about conservatism is, what are you trying to conserve? And then for a lot of the interview, he talked about the market, about market forces, and the irony. I mean, conservatism has many ironies to it, but one of them is that markets are some of the least conservative forces possible. I mean, they're enormously destructive, you know, of firms, of values.
They don't conserve stuff. They blow stuff up.
They blow stuff up. They burn stuff up. They consume stuff. They, you know, we consumed this entire continent in a record time. Or just turn on the TV, you know, just turn on the TV and see how they insult your values from start to finish. That's capitalism does that. You know, that's not liberals doing that. That's capitalism doing that. That's the market.
we have an email that was intended for Mr. Will, who's no longer with us. But why if you don't need capital in order to have labor, but you need labor in order to have capital, that labor isn't valued as being more important? You've written about.
Yeah, this. that's a really good question, and that's one of the other sort of Achilles heels of conservatism is that they can't really talk about labor presents a terrific problem for them because they'll talk and talk and talk about free markets, but then you say, okay, now you have to negotiate with these guys who work for you. No way, call in the cops. you know, absolutely not. Let's get some law and order in here.
Right. What about this distinction that Mr. Will makes between self-interest and virtue? He's saying that virtue can't be dictated by the government. And in fact, self-denial and a lack of public spiritedness was assumed by the framers and the founders. I mean, what is the role for public spiritedness? And what is the role, when you mentioned the factions, if there are people who are marginalized, what's the argument for the government, and which I use as a surrogate for a society writ large, to intervene and help out?
Well, my opinion is that that's what modern democracy is the government stepping in and helping out in all sorts of different ways. That's what a democracy does, you know, and that the government, it's totally permissible for the government to prop up this group and that. Could I change the subject slightly to consensus? Because I like that word. I mean,
as opposed to unity.
Yeah, what you were talking about before. I say I like that word, but in fact, I really hate it. And this is, I think, George Will and I would agree on this. And I think it's a function of us both living in D.C. That consensus. If you ever read the Washington Post, consensus is the great good thing for them. This is the summum bonum. This is what society is all about. Is everybody here in D.C. all of the highly educated professionals who run everything. We all agree on how everything should be run, and so therefore we don't really need democracy. We don't really need all this machinery. We don't need these parties. And the ideal for them is always the two parties getting together in the center, because everybody of good faith knows what the answers are. And then the Post always has this list of things, and you know what they are. You could probably recite them in your sleep, And I hate that attitude. I just can't stand it. If there is a consensus, I'm against it. If there is an orthodoxy, I am outside of it.
Well, you write that, government isn't even effective when we had particularly smart people. You referred to some of the Obama administration as the well-graduated mugwumps. Trump administration of being populated with particularly smart people.
Of course. So this was my own. This is an important sort of development in my own life. So when George Bush was president, I had a lot of contempt for him and his administration. And you look at the people that he put in charge of the big federal agencies, and these are people that don't believe in the mission, people that don't know what they're doing, a lot of incompetence, a lot of cronyism. Here comes Barack Obama, and I was very excited about Barack Obama, but I knew one thing for sure about him is that he would put really smart people in charge of the federal agencies. And he did. He did do that. Larry Summers was the president of Harvard, for Pete's sake, And these people proceeded to continue the policies of the George W. Bush administration vis-a-vis the big banks, the most important question of our time. It went straight on. And this was a moment of great disillusionment for me. But when you're an author like me and you have a moment of disillusionment, what do? You write about it. You try to understand it. And so what I finally came to understand is that government by expert is not all it's cracked up to be. And I sort of came to a moment of realization about this, that it basically was government by professional consensus. And professional consensuses, as we saw during the financial crisis, all the bankers agreeing on everything, professional consensuses are often really, really wrong.
Yeah, they got bailed out, the folks who were holding
those
mortgages.
That's right. And they also tend to act in their own interest. We think they're professionals, they're experts, they'll do what's right for the country. No, they'll do what's right for their friends, for their peers.
And the countervailing argument is that was the best way to staunch the bleeding, that you couldn't help out every individual homeowner who was underwater in her mortgage. Yeah.
Well, there's been efforts to do that in the past. The Roosevelt administration did that. I mean, there were many options on the table, and Obama chose the most conservative path forward. But he could have done anything he wanted with the bank industry, the financial industry in this country. They were flat on their backs. He was bailing them out. He could have done whatever.
He had a lot
of
leverage, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Your book, What's the Matter with Kansas, was written in 2005. So almost 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Are the things that you identified as being the matter with Kansas back then still the matter with Kansas now?
Well, Kansas has actually improved a little bit. It got much worse in Kansas with Governor Sam Brownback, who's one of the characters in my book. And then the state sort of reeling in disgust turned against him. But the rest of the country, meanwhile, has become one great big giant Kansas. And it is amazing to me sometimes how many of the things that I described in that book have now, you see them everywhere you go.
Yeah. Tom Frank, always good to see you. Thank you so much for coming by. I appreciate it. And good luck with the new book. Look forward to reading it.
It's my pleasure. I love to be here in beautiful Baltimore.
Thomas Frank is a political analyst and former columnist for The Guardian. He's on leave from The Guardian while he's writing this book. He's the author of 11 of them already, including What's the Matter with Kansas, Listen Liberal, and Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Society. That's it for us today. Coming up on Midday tomorrow, what you got cooking? John Shields of Gertrude's Restaurant and Damian Mosley of Black Sauce Kitchen share tips of the trade for the perfect holiday cookout. And as well, J. Wynn Russick will review Hamilton at the Hippodrome Theater. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared was recently recognized by the Daily Meal. You can find menu and hours at joesquared.com. Stay tuned. Here and Now is coming up right after the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your listening. Have a great day.